The first session, as you'll see from the slide behind me, is on the PhD Viva. And what I want you to do for a start is to imagine yourself in 4 years' time, after you've got all of the way through the programme, you've handed in first drafts of all of your chapters to your supervisors, you've responded to their comments on that, you've got a whole draft of your PhD together, it's gone through another redrafting process to the point at which you managed to make the submission in time to be a tick in the box for having completed effectively within the 4 years of your registration. Your examiners have now read your PhD, a Viva date has been set, and you're standing outside of the room, probably this room, because most PhD Vivas take place in this room. What are you going to be feeling like, do you think? What sort of moment will it be for you? Because a PhD Viva is a funny thing. There are very few things in life that you only need to do once, and where, until you've done it, you probably don't know how to do it, but as soon as you've done it once and therefore got the knowledge of how you should have done it, that knowledge is no longer operative. So it's a slightly strange process. I suspect that most of you will be feeling maybe something like this. I'm sure you won't be dressed like this. I doubt that any of you have got a purple bow tie within your wardrobe. And just to mention straight off that sartorial choices when it comes to dressing for a PhD Viva have become more casual over time. When I was a PhD student, it was not unusual for people to have to go out and buy their first ever suit just for their PhD Viva. My PhD Viva was an unusual one in that it took place in the morning, 9:30, the starting time of my Viva. By 11:30, I was already in the taxi heading for town. I'd been all right, I'd passed. A table was booked for some lunch with my supervisor, and my supervisor ordered the beer straight away at 11:45. I then met at least three different groups of friends who came and joined me at some stage during the afternoon or the evening, and I just sat there and drank for the whole of the rest of the day. The next morning I got up in a bit of a state, and I thought that I would tidy all my clothes up from the floor where I'd just thrown them as I got in, and I couldn't find my tie, and I thought that this was a bit odd. How do you go out with a tie on and not be able to find your tie the next morning? And I retraced my steps in every one of the pubs that I'd been to. I looked on all of the lampposts to see whether in jubilation I'd strung my tie up around a lamppost, and that tie has never been seen again. Luckily, there are no enforcement these days of having to dress up for Vivas. Most people will be smartish, but smart in casual clothes. So I don't think anyone has to look as though they're attending an interview or anything like that for a Viva. So you won't look like this cartoon chap in terms of what you're wearing, but you might be just as nervous as this cartoon chap. There are some quite disturbing stories of just how nervous some people have got when just about to go in for their PhD Viva. Let me share a few with you. But let me also reassure you that these are very definitely the exception and not the rule. There is a well-known professor, not in this department, but working in this country, and they were so nervous as the time came for their PhD Viva that they barricaded themselves in the closest toilet block and refused to come out. This person was not helped by the fact that security were called, and the bloke from security said, "Well, it's all right, I've got a screwdriver, I can just take the door off the hinges." But that was the state that they'd wound themselves up into. One of my first PhD students, when it came to their Viva, and this is a PhD student who now holds his own professorial position, and that is a reminder to me of how old I'm getting, that one of my former students is now a professor as well. And he was so nervous even though he'd really liked the whole of the academic environment and loved nothing more than going out to conferences and having the spotlight on him. But when the spotlight was on him for his viva, it was a completely different matter. And he'd meant to be meeting me 2 hours before his viva started so I could make sure that I'd taken him out for something to eat and that he was all right and we could have a last minute pep talk. And he didn't turn up. And I had lots of the other PhD students running around all the way back to his flat to see where he was. No sign of him at all. 5 minutes after the intended start time, he was still completely missing. The whole of the department now was running around trying to find him. And suddenly, I walked another time around the department and he was there in the meeting room. His viva had already started. He's not told me to the day where he went to or why he disappeared for the 2 hours beforehand, except for the fact that he was really, really nervous. Another one of my PhD students, I took him out for something to eat before his viva, and he was so nervous that he promptly brought it all back up again as we were crossing the road back to the university, which was embarrassing all round. And a PhD student who I was examining a couple of years ago, he was so nervous that me and the other examiner had to invite him to leave the room after 15 minutes so he could go and compose himself and to say to him, look, we'll completely disregard what's happened in the first 15 minutes. If you're able to take a break, have a drink of water and come back, we can start again as if nothing's happened. And he came back and, to his great credit, he held himself together marvellously after that. But it had car crash written all over it for the first 15 minutes. So we had to do something to make him more at ease. And that's the level at which you will remember the stories about how nervous people are. That's only four stories I know. Admittedly, two or three of them are within my experience of 70-odd PhD vivas, including my own. But that's only four stories I can tell you of that nature. However, I suspect very strongly that when it comes for time for you to be having your PhD viva, those are the sorts of stories that will come back to your mind. Because you can guarantee that if everyone in the department apart from one person tells you that really their PhD viva was okay, the examiners were nice, they were friendly, they asked challenging questions, but they were fair. And if one person tells you, oh, it was a complete nightmare, it was a total disaster from start to finish, I hated every minute of it, I hated the examiners, they clearly hated me, they didn't like the work I'd done, oh, I don't know how they passed me because it was terrible, 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 terrible. What you will remember as you're preparing for your viva are the horror stories and not the normal ones. So there are some exceptions where it's gone badly wrong for people, but those exceptions are so far and so few that you really not to expect that at all. We now have a PhD program where we know how to coax people all of the way through to a successful submission and on the back of a successful submission to have a successful PhD viva. Hopefully that is what you will bear in mind over the course of the next 4 years as you prepare eventually for your viva. But it might be that what you remember is all the horror stories because they will be the ones that you fixate on when it comes time for you to have your own viva. So then, why am I starting at the end? Because isn't it an unusual way to start the first class of the first term of the first year of a four-year process by telling you how this whole process ends? It is like having a snapshot of the end of the race without telling you at all how the race unfolded. Well, I think it is useful to let you know what you're looking at right from the word go, and it's useful for a number of reasons. Firstly, I think it tells you much more about what might go into your PhD viva, because I'll be able to tell you what examiners are looking for within the PhD viva. Secondly, I think it tells you how you can use your PhD thesis as the opening statement in what you can imagine as a dialogue with your examiners. because they will want to know about you and about your work. But the first thing that they get to encounter is not you as a person, but it's your thesis. So one of the things that a PhD thesis does is that it hides a lot of the aspects of you that went into writing it. And one of the things that your examiners are going to want to find out more about is the person who wrote the thesis. Not because they're suspicious that you've just found it on the internet and you've handed in someone else's work, but because they want to be able to match the candidate to the candidate's analysis. These things can become very important in the minds of examiners. And so if you can be told right at this stage what the PhD thesis, what the PhD viva is likely to consist of, then I think it makes it more straightforward to imagine what you need to be trying to do over the course of the next 4 years. It also means by focusing on the endpoint now, that hopefully you can bear in mind some of the pressures that are also on examiners. If you're nervous before your PhD viva, your examiners will be nervous too. Now, I'm not asking you to feel sorry for them, because their nerves are going to be of a magnitude much smaller than the nerves that you're feeling. But there is pressure on examiners too. They do get nervous, and they do want to feel that while they're on show, almost as much as you are, that they want to be able to demonstrate to you that they've taken the process seriously and that they've equipped you with a positive viva experience that hopefully you'll be able to take forward with whatever you do subsequent to your PhD career. It's also the case that PhD examiners are likely to have to give up a weekend to read your thesis. So if I can tell you what's going through their mind in the viva and how they're likely to read your thesis, you might be able to imprint within your thesis a number of things which are likely to put your examiners in a good mood as they give up their weekend to read the 80,000 words that you've written. Because the more that you can do in your written submission to put them in a good mood, the more positively they are likely to read your thesis. So the examination itself, it isn't like any other examination that you will ever have sat before, because think of what an examination feels like, think of what it looks like, and it's likely to be something like this. Lots of people sat on individual desks, all answering the same questions in the same way, in silence. That's the very antithesis of what a PhD viva is. Viva is short for viva voce, which apparently is Latin. I don't know, I didn't have a classical education. And apparently also stands for something like test by voice. So it's an examination in which you're required to speak. Every other examination that you'll ever have taken has to be sat in complete silence. So there's a change for a start. And the responsibility is on you to be communicative and to talk with your examiners. And the best way that you can do that is not to try to read any sort of malicious intent into their questioning. That it's true that the examiners are likely to ask you some difficult questions over the course of the viva, but they won't do it deliberately to try to trick you up. Nobody's there to play underhand with you. Nobody's there to try to see what you don't know. They're just giving you an invitation to talk more and more about why your PhD thesis looks as it does. So if you can get to that really perfect point of treating this just as an extended conversation with people who have given their time to read your work as closely as anyone ever in the future is ever likely to read it, then that would put you in the best possible position within your PhD viva. In the room itself, do you know how many people will be in the room alongside you?
Three.
Two examiners and one examination chair. The two examiners have a slightly different name. One is called the external, well, they will obviously have their own names, which will be different. But what I really mean is their formal position. One is called the external examiner, and that person has to be someone from outside of Warwick. The other is called the internal examiner, and that has to be somebody from within Warwick. And in almost all instances, we will select for you as an internal examiner somebody from our department. So somebody from PACE will be your internal examiner. Formally, the two examiners are of equal standing within the exam room, but informally it's usual for the internal examiner to defer to the external examiner, to allow the external examiner to lead the questioning, but then to join in as and when they want to. The two examiners will be required to submit a pre-viva report to the university before they've had any contact with one another at all. So they will come to independent judgments on the suitability of your PhD thesis. And then it's only after they've come to that judgment they will talk to one another about the sorts of questions that they want to ask you and to develop some sort of idea of what they really want to focus their questioning on. The two examiners will have read your thesis and read it closely. And they will be two of only a few people who ever read every word that you write in your thesis. Sometimes this can be a bit of a depressing thought, that you're going to spend the next 4 years of your life writing these 80,000 words, and have a guess how many people will ever have read it word for word. Well, there'll be you, because you'll have read it lots of times. There will be your supervisors. There will be your examiners. And that might be it. So your viva is conducted with two of perhaps the only four other people in the world who will ever read every word of your PhD thesis. Okay, so some of you will have very supportive parents who will try to read it as well. My parents are slightly odd in this regard, that they always insist that every time I write a book, I present them with a copy of my new book. Not one of them has ever been opened. Oh, beyond the dedication page. They're always very interested who I've dedicated my books to. They just hope it's going to be them, of course. But that's it. These books just sit on their bookshelves in pristine condition, gathering dust. And it might be the same with your PhD thesis, that members of your immediate family might like the idea of having a copy of it, but what they're going to do with it, they might use it as a door prop or something like that. But read it is probably not what they're going to do. But the people sitting around the other side of the table will have read it, and will have read it intently. Because really there are two parts to the examination of a PhD. The first part is when the examiners take take control of your thesis. It will be sent through the post by the graduate school to them. And when it lands in their pigeonhole, they know they've got a substantial piece of work to read. And that's when they will come to a provisional decision as to what sort of award they're going to recommend to the university. In other words, in the minds of the examiners, they won't be absolutely certain what the recommendation is going to be before the viva starts, but they will have a good idea. They will have a good idea of the sort of range of recommendations that they think they're going to be choosing between at the end of the viva. So the viva itself is only the second stage in the examination process. And if you were to ask me to be honest about this, I would tell you it's the less important of the two stages of the examination process. It won't feel like this to you, because this is the big moment. This is the big moment when you're called in to have this conversation over maybe a couple of hours with your examiners, and you know exactly how much is riding on that. However, the very important moment in the examination has already taken place, unbeknownst to you, when the examiners read your written submission and they fill in their independent pre-viva report. Because even though there's two stages to the examination process, I think it would be wrong to try to suggest to you that they're symmetrical. Let me explain what I mean by this. If you have written an outstanding PhD, there is nothing that you can do that would be so spectacularly wrong in the Viva that you won't get awarded a PhD for it. However unfortunate your performance in the Viva, you cannot talk yourself into more corrections than the examiners were of a mind to give in the first place. However, it works in your favour here. However, it is possible for a good performance in the Viva to allow the examiners to set fewer corrections than they were of a mind to set in the first place. So this is a bit like a one-way street for you. I think you can only win from your Viva. You can only make the final recommendation better than the examiners were thinking about. You cannot make it worse. So one thought that might come to your mind when you can imagine yourself sitting here with these two all-important people, your PhD examiners, is that that could be rather daunting. You can imagine what it's like coming into the room and seeing them sitting there for the first time, and you're trying to read all sorts of things into their body language and whether their smile is that much or that much or that much when they say hello to you. You will be second-guessing everything they say and everything that they do. And that can be quite scary as well. So maybe these scary thoughts come back somewhat as to the Viva itself. But the Viva, important though it is not so important that it outweighs the significance of the written submission and of what the examiners have made of the written submission. There are also a number of stories that I could tell you about how students have been uncommunicative, unwilling to engage with their examiners, possibly even outright rude to their examiners, and denying the examiners the right to conduct the examination in the way that they saw best. But because they've written a good PhD, they are still given the PhD at the end of that. It might be an exaggeration to suggest that you could turn up dressed in a clown suit and stand on your head for the whole of the Viva, and as long as the written submission is okay, then you will still be given a PhD. But it's not too much of an exaggeration. So what I'm telling you is that the Viva is something to take seriously, and of course you're going to do that. There's no way you're going to try to fritter away 4 years of hard work by not preparing yourself sufficiently for your Viva. But the real crux of the decision that the examiners come to is going to be in what they make of the written submission that you've already submitted. So if you can follow your programme over the course of the next 4 years, moving from progression point to progression point, discussing your chapter drafts with your supervisors, getting as much support from one another as possible, I'm absolutely sure that all of you can arm yourself with a written submission on PhD deadline day that will make the Viva okay. It might not feel as though it's okay when you're sitting there and you're panicking a little bit, but it will be, honestly. It's not a stupid question, because if it is, it means that my presentation is going to veer into the realm of the stupid, because it's one of the next things that I'm going to tell you about.
What is the question? How does it classify? What's the mark?
I'll get to that in a minute.
At some point, you may tell us the kind of corrections that what kinds of corrections?
I will tell you that, yeah. Because that also comes under the there's types of recommendations that the examiners are allowed to make.
So I have a question regarding the examiners. Basically, back in my university, the idea was that in some instances you had some contact with the examiners, as in, like, you know, but in others it was preferred not to communicate with them because, you know, you want them to give their unbiased opinion. So how does it what's the process involved?
Well, this is where the rules enter a bit of a grey area. Because if you search deeply enough on the university's website, you do get to all sorts of different regulations. And the norm, certainly from my day onwards, was always that the examiners should be people that you'd had no contact with. But this became increasingly ridiculous. The more the PhD students go out into the professional community, the more that they attend conferences, the more that they give papers, the more that they see other people giving papers, there aren't these hard and fast walls that separate PhD students from the professional community more generally. So I think it's almost inevitable now that you will know your PhD examiners. For instance, how could you ever be internally examined by someone from the department and ensure that you never met them, spoken to them, knew who they were or anything like that? It does get a bit preposterous at that level. And I would always want to take it one stage further. I would never, ever allow my PhD students to be examined by somebody that they were uncomfortable with, somebody that I didn't know whether I could vouch for how they were going to act within the Viva, and somebody that they didn't have at least an experience of seeing them in public, so they would have a face in their minds as they were preparing for their Viva. They would have a sense of the type of person they were. They would know how they spoke. Just being able to hear somebody's voice in your head, I think, demystifies the whole process.
So just to be clear, the supervisors get some sort of a say who gets to be the examiner for their students' process?
Formally, by university regulations, it's solely a decision for the examiners. It's solely a decision for the supervisors who the examiners are going to be. But I think that it's the best possible practice for the supervisors to include the students in the discussion as to who the most suitable examiners would be. And those discussions can often be quite sweet from a supervisor's perspective. Let me give you a sense of how they often take shape. Firstly, in a PhD supervision, student says, and finally, I think we must talk about examiners. And I will say, does that mean you've been thinking about your potential examiners? Yes, comes the response. To which I ask, well, who do you have in mind? There is then somebody who's probably the biggest name in the whole profession who works somewhere in California, never having operated within the UK system, not knowing what the standards of a UK PhD programme are, also never having examined anyone in this face-to-face manner before, and being far too far away for the university to pay their travel fees anyway. So we have to get that out of the way, and then we start talking about the sorts of people that the students have come across in conferences, the people who they feel comfortable in front of, the people who they've seen make other people feel comfortable when talking to them. And those sorts of decisions are also built into, sorry, those sorts of conditions are also built into the decision as who to invite. Because it's absolutely fine getting big name Professor X to act as the external examiner. But if big name Professor X is difficult, and if big name Professor X has a reputation for causing problems for PhD students, why on earth would you invite big name Professor X to have a say as to the recommendation as to whether your student passes or not? So it is nice to get people with a big academic reputation to be the examiners, because they can be very, very useful referees subsequently. But at the same time, I would also want them to have a reputation for being student friendly and for acting in a fair and open manner within PhD Vivas. And make no mistake about this, we work in such a small profession that if anyone isn't student friendly in PhD fivers, and if anyone isn't fair to the PhD students who they're examining, word gets around like wildfire. It spreads unbelievably quickly as to how certain, let's call them big name Professor X again, how big name Professor X has overstepped the mark and shouldn't be allowed anywhere near PhD examinations. So we keep our ear to the ground and we listen for these things, and they're all built into the discussion. And I really would want it to be a discussion between you and your supervisors as to who gets invited to be your examiner, because they play such an important role for you. Not just the examination itself, but all the opportunities they might help to bring your way after the examination, through writing references, through putting your way job opportunities, for instance, that might look interesting for you. So the supervisors have to get those decisions right, and you're going to be most comfortable with those if you feel as though you were an active part in making that decision in the first instance. Alan, did you have a question from before?
No, that actually essentially got answered. I was curious about the selection of the external examiner. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they would need to have the right reputation at a number of different levels. They need to have the right a degree of expertise, the right academic reputation, but also somebody that you can vouch for as a person, and knowing that that person would do right within the examination. Anyone else? While we're talking about the selection of examiners, should I tell you what the chair does? Because there will be that strange person who's sitting there, possibly being distracted by their mobile phone a little bit too much, if my experience of examination chairs is anything to go by. They're there to make sure, they're there as a representative of the university, to make sure that university regulations are abided by, and also to make sure that the spirit of university regulations are abided by. Of course, if you get the choice of examiners right in the first place, then there's no need for the examination chair, because they don't have to intervene to say, tut, 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 that question isn't allowed, that was too aggressively asked, or anything like that. But they're there as some sort of backstop, that if they can see that the student is having a hard time, that they might want to intervene to try to make sure that relations within the examination room are normalised in a way that means that the student doesn't have such a tough time for the rest of the viva. So they're there sort of as your friend, and they're there formally on behalf of the university, but they're there to look out for your interests. They're there to ensure fair play takes place. So as much of a referee as a chair. And it might be, because they're not allowed formally to speak within the viva, unless it's to tell the examiners off, it might be that you only hear them say something on a couple of occasions, that they'll bring you in and introduce you to your examiners, who you might know anyway, and then they will tell you when the examination is over. But as your examiners have already told you that anyway, you will know. So that's always nice and straightforward. What about the viva itself? What sort of questions do you think you might get within a viva? For those people who haven't been told what to expect, it can often come as quite a surprise that examiners tend to focus on big, broad, sweeping, general questions. They're less likely to focus on specific minutiae of the argument itself. One of the ways that lots of PhD students can work themselves up into a real state before their viva is that they read their own thesis again and again and again and again, and they read it for all the things that they think they can spot wrong with it. And of course, if you read your own work having adopted that frame of mind, you can almost certainly find something wrong with it on every page, maybe in every paragraph. And that can be a cause of alarm for lots of PhD students, because they think that their examiners will read their PhD thesis in the same way that they're reading it. And honestly, we don't. We read it for the strength of the general argument. We read it for the excitement that you can convey from your 4 years of dedicated research time that you can bring to the subject matter and enliven it for the reader. We will be interested in the way that you position yourself in relation to the rest of the academic profession. We will want to know your thoughts about the relationship between your work and the relationship with the existing academic literature. If you're sitting there thinking, oh no, I hope they don't realise that what I said in the footnote in page 271 partially contradicts a claim that I made on page 14, then no, nobody's going to spot that. Nobody's going to have any idea about that at all, except for the PhD student who's read their own work with such a critical frame of mind that they think they can spot mistakes that will jettison their chances of passing at every turn. The story I told you about my PhD student who didn't have a very good relationship with the dinner that I bought him immediately before his fiver, he'd worked himself up into a state by doing precisely that. He thought that on every page there was a reason for his examiners to fail him. And if you convince yourself that that's the case, you can imagine just how scary the PhD fiver might be. But examiners are interested in those big questions. They'll be interested in the way that the thesis fits together, but they will be interested in the way that it fits together in terms of the sorts of arguments that that then allows you to make. One of the things that lots of PhD students say after the end of their viva was that they were surprised how few questions they got on their empirical work. And that tends to be quite a repeated pattern. And I think that's actually quite normal. This isn't to say that your empirical work is in any way unimportant, far from it. It's just that if you do your empirical work well, your examiners will happily defer to you. They will tell you that you're the expert now on this empirical work, not them, and that they're happy to go with the conclusions that you've derived from it. They'll be much more interested in how those empirical conclusions fit in with the broader structure of argumentation within the thesis. So that can be a surprise if you're not forewarned that writing the empirical chapters for just about everyone is a really time-consuming effort that they put a huge amount of energy into. And they don't always get asked much about them within the viva. And that's usually a sign that they've done it so well that there's no need to ask those questions subsequently. So even though you might go in thinking, well, it's obviously the empirical work that they're going to focus on most, it usually isn't. Shall I now tell you the sorts of recommendations that the examiners can make? And formally, they do only make recommendations. It's up to the university to make the decision as to whether the degree has been awarded or not. I've never known an instance where the examiners say, yes, the PhD should be awarded, and the university turns around and says, no, it shouldn't. That doesn't happen. The university might delay the conferral of the award of a PhD if, for instance, you have outstanding library fines and you need to pay those off first. But the university is the only, that's the level at which the conferral of the degree is made. But at that level, it's really only a rubber stamping exercise. As long as the examiners show the university that they've conducted the viva in a manner that's consistent with the university regulations, then the university will always go with the recommendation that the examiners make. So really, the examiners are making the decision, but formally, it's not a decision, it's only a recommendation. Hopefully, here's a website. You probably require a telescope if you're sitting at the back of the room to be able to see this, especially as my rather overly large head is probably in the way. If you've got, if anyone's got their laptop around so that some other people can see this, just type into the Warwick search engine, Guide to Examinations for Higher Degrees by Research, and you will find that there's an extraordinary amount of information on those pages. The information in general divides into three. That there are three parts down the bottom here. Part one, guidance to students on submission and examination of the thesis. That's a useful source of information for you, because one of the biggest things that can cause an awful amount of trouble for students at the end of their PhD process is that they haven't presented it in the right way. They haven't got their bibliography up and running. They haven't got it in the style that the graduate school asks for. And if they're working right up until the deadline, to be able to find a few days to put everything in the right style can actually be a source of additional stress. So a tip, I suppose, along the way is to have a read of this guidance to students on submission and examination of the thesis at a very early stage and try to align your writing practices with the style that the university asks for. The bit in the middle is the guidance to academic departments and supervisors on research degree examinations. There's a lot of detail there, but it's only telling us what we already really know about how you navigate the process of nominating examiners. And the third bit, what I want to concentrate on for the rest of this afternoon, is part three, guidance to examiners on the conduct of research degree examinations. So this is the information, in other words, that will be sent to your PhD examiners in advance of your viva. It will usually be tucked in the front cover of your submitted PhD thesis, and it falls out on the floor as soon as you open the PhD up to read it. Some universities will send you up to 50 pages worth of regulations. Given the average academic, how many of those 50 pages do you think that we actually get round to read? I think most of the time we pretend that we already know exactly what we're doing and therefore we don't have to read any of it. But that wasn't for the tape. I can't be quoted on that. So this is what that page looks like as you scroll down. And look at just how many regulations there are. Because each of these numbers, if you were to click on the links for any of those, that would then open up a whole range of new pages. What I want to focus on in particular is this one just here, the recommendations available to examiners, which is a good thing because you've already been asking me about it. Here they are, a list of all the recommendations that are available to examiners. You can have a look at those at your leisure to see exactly what the examiners will be choosing between. Let me start with the first of those that is going to be of interest to you, and this is 5.2. This is called Award Degree in Question. Now that sounds rather bland, doesn't it? Could you imagine yourself getting excited about being told that you will have the degree in question awarded? It sounds rather soporific in the language, but this is the most exciting result that you could possibly get. Now, when you talk to your colleagues on the PhD programme, especially those that are going through the later years and are probably waiting for their viva now, they won't talk about this as the recommendation that the degree in question be awarded. This is what they will call no corrections, or perhaps a little more formally, a pass with no corrections. And of course, this is what everyone is hoping for. And the reason that they're hoping, bless you, the reason that they're hoping for this is that that then ends the long slog of finishing your PhD. Because a PhD is a slightly strange thing because it finishes at about six distinct points in time. Firstly, you will get a sense that you've sort of finished the first time that you can convince yourself that you have a draft of every one of your chapters. And now, if pushed, you could then print it off tomorrow and hand it in the next day. Another time that you think you've finished is when you submit the full first draft, so that first draft of everything, to your supervisors. That will be a good day along the timeline of your PhD studies. You will be delighted with yourself at that point. Another finishing point is when you've incorporated all of the changes that your supervisors are recommending into your pre-submitted degree. And then you start working on those very last final bits where you're trying to get all of the formatting right, all of the textual corrections undertaken. It will also feel as though you've finished the day that you hand it in to the graduate school, and what's becoming increasingly common now, when you get somebody to take a picture of you on your phone, when you're holding it open, just as you're submitting it. I quite like that. That's a nice new tradition. All of my six PhD students who finished this year have all sent me pictures of them submitting the PhD, and I've kept them all. It's really nice. So please do that. But then the Viva itself is another day, supposedly, when you finish. And then there might be some corrections to do. So is that another day when you finished? And you can't actually officially call yourself doctor until you receive the conferral letter from the university, which I think is the seventh finishing date. And it might be that you will come back and parade around in some fancy robes and go to your graduation and be given a certificate by someone or other who's just paid to shake hands with you. So there could be eight that was a very rude thing to say about my friend the Vice Chancellor, wasn't it? And so there could be eight distinct finishing points of the PhD. So to be told that you'll that the recommendation is that you pass without corrections, that does feel like a big thing. Because it feels as though those finishing points are being compressed and you're really nearly at the end there. So that's a good thing. However, pass with no corrections can mean at least one of two distinct things. Emma, I think you asked about, not just about the recommendations, but about classifications. How do you know how well you've done? Well, for a PhD, there aren't any classifications as there are for other degrees, and there's nothing like a numerical mark for a PhD. And that can sometimes come as a bit of a surprise to people who are just starting their PhD programmes. I started on a small PhD programme. I think there were five people who began in my year. And on the equivalent session where somebody was talking to us on an induction day about the PhD, and I was sitting round the table where you are now, one person from our group said, "What do you mean? There aren't any numerical marks for a PhD. What do you mean? How will it be possible for me to lord my intellectual superiority over everyone else if I don't know how much better than them I am?" This wasn't me, by the way. This is definitely one of the others. And of the five of us, the four of us were really good friends all the way through, and he was sort of on the outside of our friendship circles. I'm sure you can imagine that all he wanted to be able to do was not to have the thrill of studying for a PhD, not to be able to push himself to see exactly what he was capable of. He really wanted to finish his programme knowing that he was better than the rest of us. But there aren't any degree classifications, there aren't any numerical marks. And sometimes people do understand these awards as they go down, as going from best to worst. And I think that that's, at one level, probably true. But there are also some important qualifications. Because in general, there are two distinct ways in which you can be recommended a pass with no corrections. It could be that your PhD thesis is so good and so impressive that the PhD examiners sit there and think, well, there's nothing that can be done to make that better. It's just really, really good. Well done. But I've given out just as many pass with no corrections recommendations, I think, when a completely different set of circumstances apply. And that's where you think, yes, on balance, there's enough here to be awarded a PhD, but if I started to recommend changes to you, then as soon as we were to get into the logic of the changes, it would probably be requiring you pretty much to rip it up and start again. And at that point, if the examiners come to the decision that, yes, there is enough here, then there is no point in setting corrections that really couldn't be done within the basis of the original PhD thesis. So you can get, on the one hand, such an outstanding piece of work that it doesn't look as though it can be bettered, equals pass with no corrections, and a marginal just over the crossbar, but it would be unfair because it would cause too much aggro to the student to ask them to do any corrections, that's a pass with no corrections as well. Yeah, so it gets a bit complicated and very difficult to compare one recommendation with another in circumstances such as that.
Sort of fair assumption to say most vivas are usually passed with minor corrections, right?
Yeah, probably. Probably. I think when I was going through the process, everyone was told to expect corrections. And then it would almost be a sign of the quality of the program that you were on, whether most people got major corrections or most people got minor corrections. If you'd had good people around you that you could talk to and you could use their experiences to also enhance the quality of your academic work, then most people getting minor corrections might be true. Shall I show you what this recommendation actually looks like? Because you would imagine, would you not, it's the highest possible degree you can study for. Here are the recommendations that examiners can make. You might be presuming that there's pages and pages and pages of what it would mean to get this recommendation. Not a bit of it. That's it. The recommendation that the degree be awarded is the recommendation that the degree be awarded. And that's pretty much it, formally.